Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. Here's a situation that can happen in a school classroom. A teacher is guiding a class of 25 students through a lesson. Among those students is a boy with autism. He's a bright student, not usually a problem. Maybe he has an aide assigned to him. Suddenly, he becomes agitated. He loses control. He tips over his desk, starts throwing things. What is the teacher to do? Is he or she to call the parents, call the police? One option schools use is something called a seclusion room, a separate room where a disruptive child is taken to calm down so he does not hurt himself, hurt others. Once he's calmed down, he returns to the classroom. That's how it is supposed to work. But an investigation by the Columbus Dispatch and State Impact Ohio, that's the public radio education reporting team, found that teachers and administrators often misuse these seclusion rooms. That's our topic for this hour. Seclusion rooms, are they necessary? Are they useful? And the larger issue, the so-called mainstreaming of folks with of students with special needs and disabilities and emotional disorders in with other students in public schools. Our first guest, Jennifer Smith Richards, education reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Jennifer, you worked on this story. How common are these rooms?
We found that they're pretty common. We kind of looked at a small slice of districts across the state of Ohio, looked at about 100 of them. And among those, about 40% said they have some sort of space where they isolate kids or seclude kids.
So 40% of the districts you surveyed.
That's correct.
What do these rooms look like?
So they take sort of varying shapes. Some of them really do look like small cells. They're very sparse. There's no furniture inside. Many of them have mats on the walls and on the floors. Some of them are emptied out classrooms. And some of them have video monitors so that outside teachers can monitor. And some have one-way mirrors, again, so teachers can monitor and children can be left inside.
So those rooms, the ones with mirrors and one-way mirrors and video monitoring and the padding on the walls, mats, that's what they are there for. They are there to seclude, to help a student who's being disruptive.
Sure, that's their function.
How long have they been in use?
I mean, as long as we can tell. I mean, there is a long history of seclusion in mental health facilities and psychiatric facilities. But in many cases, especially, you know, including here in Ohio, the use in other types of facilities outside of public schools is pretty regulated. So there are very specific uses for seclusion in other spaces, but not in Ohio public schools.
Molly Bloom is a reporter for State Impact Ohio. It's the collaboration between NPR, Ohio Public Radio Stations, WCPN, WKSU, and WOSU. Molly worked on this story. Molly, what are the rules for using seclusion rooms?
Well, really, there aren't a lot of rules. There aren't any state policies on how these rooms should be used in schools in Ohio. About a dozen of the schools that we surveyed actually had policies about how seclusion rooms are supposed to be used. But all the others, the ones that are actually using seclusion rooms, they did not have formal policies about how the rooms are supposed to be used.
It's probably good to point out, too, that even those who did have policies, they very seldom spelled out how they're not supposed to be used, for example, for punishment or you know, other disciplinary measures. Just maybe a handful actually spelled out, don't abuse these rooms, and teachers are not to be using these rooms for respite or for a break.
Mm-hmm. Molly, what was the explanation as to why there weren't any rules? Just that they hadn't gotten around to it, or they what was some of the explanations why they don't have the rules?
The explanations were things like, well, you know, our staff know how to use these rooms. It's in the child's individual education plan. We don't need to have a district-wide policy setting out rules about how the rooms are supposed to be used. I think some advocates would say when you don't have a policy on how the rooms are supposed to be used, people will make up their own reasons and have their own understandings for how they're supposed to be used.
We're talking about the use of seclusion rooms for special needs students who are, in theory, disruptive and need to be separated from the regular classroom. Our guests are Jennifer Smith Richards from the Columbus Dispatch and Molly Bloom from State Impact Ohio. For more information on this story, you can go to our website, WOSU.org, and click on State Impact, or you can go to ColumbusDispatch.com, where they have a special section for this investigation. Our question for you, the listener, are you the parent of a child with a disorder or with special needs, and that child attends public school. Are you a teacher with experience with special education students? We'd like you to share your experiences. Give us a call at 292-8513. That number is 292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Also look for us on Facebook and Twitter as well. So, Jennifer, the rooms are, in theory, designed if a student is being overly disruptive, throwing things, being really a physical danger to the classroom, to the teacher. That's what, in theory, that's what they're supposed to be used for.
Right, for situations in which kids become violent. And it does happen. These are children who have significant disabilities, serious emotional disturbances. Often these are kids who are not actually being educated in the mainstream. These are, in many cases, what we saw, separate classrooms that are just for students who have emotional disturbances. And they can become violent. They do become upset. They do self-injure. But that's simply not the way that we found that schools are using these rooms. They really are, in many cases, putting a child in a seclusion room, for example, for throwing a pencil, for swearing, for disobeying the teacher, for refusing to do work.
Mm-hmm. Molly, what is a teacher to do in that case? Even if it's in a class with other special needs students, the teacher has to do something. What are the options that teacher has if there is no seclusion room?
Well, first of all, I would just say that the teachers who work in these classrooms are really, you know, for the most part, really dedicated, hardworking people who deal with children who can be really, really challenging to deal with. They come in with a certain amount of training on how to understand what children are trying to tell them when the children behave in certain ways. And so the idea is that teachers understand what the child is trying to communicate when, for example, they start, when they throw a pencil, and figure out how to direct them to a more positive behavior without having to just shut them into a room. So that kind of positive behavior management is what they're supposed to do. But that's really hard to do.
How long are the children in these seclusion rooms?
You know, it varies. Some districts, the ones that do have policies, set time limits. 1 minute per year of age, or no more than 10 minutes. Other districts, we looked at the logs, and there were children left in there for, you know, an hour at a time, for example.
Jennifer, there was one picture in the newspaper and on our website had a room with a square in the middle of the room with an X on it, and it said calm. And tell us the story of how that room is supposed to work.
So it's supposed to work, you know, the way that seclusion rooms are generally defined, in that you're putting a child in there for the purpose of them calming down so that they don't hurt themselves or others. And in that particular room, a child is taken inside, and they need to calm themselves down. And once they're calm and ready to return to the classroom, they go and they stand on that tile with the X on it that's marked calm, to let the person who's watching them through the video monitor or at the doorway know that they're ready to go back to class.
Did that work? Did the students understand that's what they have to do? And Even students with severe emotional problems and disabilities, they understand they have to go to the calm square and stand there.
Sure. And, I mean, they understand that they have to be calm to return to the classroom as well. And we heard lots of stories from schools where they'd say, you know, we have kids who ask to go to these rooms. They ask to go there and calm down. And that they do. They go in, they take a few minutes, whatever's upsetting them, they've been able to soothe themselves, and then they're able to return to the classroom.
Molly, parents... Some parents object to this, obviously, especially if a child's been put there for a minor offense, if you could use that term, or if they've been kept there for too long a time. But other parents, Molly, they don't want to be called at work. They want the school to handle this.
Yeah, I mean, particularly in, you know, when you have parents who are working, who may have really not being able to leave school. To leave their work. Mm-hmm. If their kid acts up in school, the school calls them, says, you know, come get your kid, we can't handle him. That's not good for the parent either.
We're talking about seclusion rooms and dealing with children in schools that have severe disabilities or severe emotional disorders that can sometimes become disruptive. What is a teacher to do? What are school administrators to do? Some use seclusion rooms. The Dispatch and State Impact Ohio have found that many times, these rooms are being used improperly. Jennifer Smith-Richards from the Dispatch, what is the long-term harm of these seclusion rooms?
So there's not an abundance of research about this, but there's some. And we understand now that there is a danger of physical harm to children. I mean, we saw that play out in a Columbus school this past school year. There's a danger of harm to the child. There's a danger, of course, of harm to the teacher who's trying to wrestle a student, perhaps unwillingly, into a seclusion room. But there's also sort of a psychological trauma that parents and researchers describe. You are essentially putting a child into a confined space. And for a child who already has disabilities, that can be really terrifying. And parents have told us that it has a long-term traumatic effect for their children, and they never forget the experience.
292-8513, if you'd like to join in our discussion. Are you the parent of a special needs student? Have you worked in schools with special needs students? Give us a call, 292-8513. Molly, can you add to that? What have parents told you about the harm that their children have suffered who've been in these rooms?
Well, one thing that's been mentioned to me is that sometimes these are children who have been abused, either physically or sexually. And so having someone, an adult, come and put their hands on them and force them into a room, because often when we're talking about this, they're being escorted or forced into the room, is traumatic for them. It brings back, you know, memories of the trauma that happened to them before. And it also sets the precedent that, okay, it's okay for other people, for adults, to do this to me.
Besides seclusion rooms, are there other strategies that teachers use? Use the hallway, a chair in the hallway, another, go to the nurse's clinic or something like that. Are there other, not seclusion rooms, but other tactics to separate a disruptive student from the classroom?
So one parent that I spoke with said, you know, if there is no seclusion room in a school, they will find a way to isolate and seclude your child. And this is a parent, obviously, who had a bad experience with seclusion. Mm-hmm. But the answer is yes. I mean, there are many different forms that this can take, including, you know, they call it timeout or isolation, or, you know, they do occasionally send a child out to the hallway. But I'm not sure that that's exactly the same thing as seclusion. You know, taking a child out of a classroom to remove them from some sort of stimulus and to get them to sort of calm down, stop getting attention from other children, perhaps, mm-hmm. when they're acting out, walking out in the hallway so they can calm down is quite different from what we're talking about. But we did have parents also tell us that, you know, we're talking about converted office spaces sometimes, you know, like you mentioned, a nurse's office or a converted band or music practice room. These are spaces that they're using for other purposes, but also use with the function in mind that we're going to isolate a child.
Molly Bloom from State Impact Ohio, how does the staffing work? When you know, you're a teacher and you have 25 students, or maybe you have 10 students if it's a special education classroom, you have to leave that room, bring the student to the seclusion area, whether it's a room or someplace else. Don't you need two staff people to monitor both locations?
Yeah, sure. When most of the, as Jennifer said, most of the rooms that we looked at were part of classrooms that were set aside for children with emotional disturbances. And these usually have about 8 students per class with a teacher and at least 1, if not 2, aides. Mm-hmm. So restraining a child, secluding them, takes the attention of at least two staff members who then are not there to, you know, manage the behavior of the rest of the children and to teach them. A lot of classrooms do use sort of a team approach, though, and we can see in the records the district sent that they'll call in the assistant principal, they'll call in a teacher from another classroom to sort of help cover the classroom. But it takes resources, it certainly does.
And one shouldn't think that using seclusion is not disruptive. I mean, if the behavior itself is disruptive inside the classroom, so is that process of getting a child into a seclusion room.
Jennifer Smith-Richards from the Dispatch, do you ever see these being banned? I know there are groups that want these done away with completely, seclusion rooms. Do you see them? Do you see that ever happening in Ohio?
It doesn't appear that that's going to happen in Ohio. And I should note that seclusion is banned in schools in some states, and more than 30 states have some sort of restriction on the use of seclusion. For Ohio, the officials here have indicated they're not going to ban seclusion. Ohio is a local control state. We put a lot of trust in our school districts here to make decisions that they think are in the best interest of kids, and this is one of those issues that's going to be left to school districts. ODE is currently writing a policy that would sort of place some restrictions and some and offer some guidelines and some guidance for districts if they do want to use restraint and seclusion.
Molly Bloom from State Impact Ohio, how tough do you think, though, how specific will those guidelines be? Is there a call that you cannot put a student in there for just swearing, and will they be that specific?
Well, it seems like they're getting ready to release the draft, an initial draft of them this month. There's actually an earlier version up on our website. And it seems like the direction they're heading is that they should only be used if there's an emergency, if the child is at risk of hurting themselves or others. I guess the other thing that the new guidelines would do would actually require schools to report some information about how they use seclusion to the state, because right now there's really no good way of knowing how it's used in the state besides doing the kind of survey that we did.
All right. Thanks very much. That's Molly Bloom from State Impact Ohio, Jennifer Smith-Richards from the Columbus Dispatch. If you want to read more about this, visit the Columbus Dispatch website, or you can visit our website, WOSU.org, and click on State Impact. And part two of the radio version of this story will air tomorrow morning. And parts one and two are in the paper, of course, on Saturday, on Sunday and Monday, Sunday and today on the Columbus Dispatch. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having us.
When we return, we'll talk to an advocate for folks who with disabilities who want to be included in school and other areas of society. That's when All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Neil Conan. In the week ahead on Talk of the Nation, the threat of cyber attacks and the debate over how to prepare and respond. On Tuesday, the mysterious death of an outspoken activist in Cuba. Political junkie Ken Rudin drops by on Wednesday with a new trivia question. Join guest host Tom Gelton for that and, of course, much more in the coming week on Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation, Monday through Friday from 2 until 4 on 89.7 NPR News. 75 degrees with sunshine in downtown Columbus. Sunny skies today warming up to a high near 85. Clear skies tonight, a low of 58 degrees. Sunshine and a high of 87 for Tuesday.
Support for 89.7 comes from Kosai, exploding with dynamic exhibits, live shows, 3D movies, and adventures that are made for families to enjoy together. More information about summer fun is at kosai.org/save.
All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson, sitting in for Ann today. We are talking about the use of seclusion rooms. They are rooms in schools used to separate disruptive special needs students. In theory, it's to separate these students when they are being, you know, physically dangerous, harming themselves, of harming the teacher, harming other students. They are rooms where the student is separated. Some have matting or padding. Some have closed-circuit cameras to try to separate the student until they calm down, then bring them back. But the Columbus Dispatch and State Impact Ohio have found that many times these rooms are being used for other reasons, including punishment for, you know, relatively minor offenses compared to what I just described. Joining us now is Barb Trader. She is the executive director of TASH. That is a group that advocates for the inclusion of people with disabilities. Barb, welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Barb, what's the proper role of seclusion rooms?
TASH members and our research shows that there is no real proper use of seclusion rooms. In fact, we advocate for the prohibition of seclusion throughout the United States.
Mm-hmm. Why do you want to do away with them completely?
Because they've been found to be dangerous for students. They are traumatic. They have led to death and student injury and there's nothing positive that comes out of them. In fact, the Government Accountability Office in their report in 2009 state very clearly that there is no therapeutic or educational benefit that results from seclusion rooms. They do not prevent dangerous or challenging behavior by students, and there's no reason for them. And that's the Government Accountability Office that made that statement.
We'd like you to join our conversation, 292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Barb Trader is the executive director of TASH, a group that advocates for inclusion of people with disabilities. Barb, so what is a teacher to do if a student is being very disruptive, perhaps throwing things, tipping over a desk, at risk of becoming violent towards the teacher, towards other students, towards him or herself? What is a teacher to do if seclusion rooms are not available?
Well, the really effective practice, in fact, we call it evidence-based practice because research has shown that it works so well, as positive behavior supports, which means that the challenging behavior is prevented from the get-go, that students are not motivated to turn over desks or threaten other kids, that through a process of understanding what is the basis for the behavior in the first place, and accommodating the student so either the environment changes or their needs are supported in some other way, or the cause of the behavior is dealt with directly and productively, that the behavior won't exist. Behavior comes from something. Kids don't just explode. And we have to understand that these kids are not bad. They have reasons for their behavior. It's a communication of sorts that something is needed. And when teachers take the time and are trained and supported effectively to understand how to have that depth of understanding for each student, then they have no need for a seclusion room.
But what you say is it work in theory would be great, but there will be occasions where something very disruptive will occur. Is seclusion or separation an appropriate thing to do in that occasion?
No, and on a rare occasion, a student will do something, but there are many other productive ways to intervene, such as blocking what the child is about to do, understanding what works for that child when they have lost their own control of their behavior. But even in schools that work specifically with students that have severe behaviors, such as the Centennial School in Pennsylvania and the Lane School in Oregon and the Grafton School in Virginia, there are several others, they do not implement seclusion. Mm-hmm. They have found that they don't need it, that there are many other ways that are much more humane, much more respectful of a child, and much more likely to result in future positive behaviors.
292-8513 is our phone number, 292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're talking about the use of seclusion rooms to cope with disruptive special needs students in schools. And Mike, you're on the air.
I must disagree with our last speaker. I spent 30 years teaching with severely mentally disabled kids for the county developmentally disabled program. And I did tend to get the most severely handicapped, the biggest guys, because I was good at it and because I was a guy. This would be an extreme example, but I had one student who was 270 pounds of severely mentally disabled and lots of problems with the background and this kind of stuff student. And he had calluses and everything all over his face and his hands from biting himself, hitting himself, all this kind of stuff. Now, and you have someone that size physically attacking you or students or whatever several times every day. I mean, and often several times in an hour, you have to do something. You can't sit there and watch it. Now, long-term, yes, using positive stuff to build on that will work, and that's what you work on very hard. But in the meantime, you have to have some tools. Now, I can tell you, at that time, we got rid of in the program for political reasons and others, I suppose. We totally got rid of the timeout room. But our jobs became harder. It was tougher on the kid because it took that much longer to come up with a program that worked. We used to be able to have a timeout room where we could get him into it. And we're not talking about for throwing a pencil, maybe kicking three times within 1 minute. Other than that, well, that's okay. Not okay, but you know what I mean.
You could tolerate it.
We had other intervention, the redirection, the blocking, and that kind of stuff. But when you have a 270-pound person kicking and hitting and stuff and literally breaking furniture and plate glass windows and stuff, you need an intervention. And I'll tell you what the problem was. Once they eliminated that and other stuff, teachers who felt a little less capable, or maybe they were older people and a 140-pound woman trying to deal with this and other kids at the same time, I know what they did. I had one former teacher say, well, I'm not going to tell you I did this, but if I were you, I would pick up, and she pointed to a heavy metal chair, and hit him with it, because that's the only thing she knew to do.
Barb,
and that's the alternative.
Let's let our guest, Barb Trader, from the group TASH, that advocates for inclusion of folks with disabilities. Barb, how do you react to stories like that?
Well, that's what a lot of people will say, but they're not in a system that supports the use of positive behavior supports effectively. There are large school districts, urban school districts, that prohibit seclusion. The entire state of Georgia prohibits the use of seclusion. They do these things for a reason, and that is they have supported their school personnel in laying the groundwork early enough, particularly early enough in a child's life, to do the preventative work that's necessary to not have these situations happen in the first place. If this individual that the speaker refers to is engaged in self-injurious behaviors, those things can be a great indication of something that really needs to be resolved, and staff need to be supported and trained to understand what's causing that kind of behavior so that they can deal with the individual effectively.
Mike, you're back on the air. Just if you could quickly respond to that, then we want to move on to other callers. But just from your experience, what do you think?
She's probably right. I'll buy that. But I can tell you this, when you're talking about a student with those kind of needs, we don't have that many staff. We don't, and we're not going to, but especially given the economic situation. We're not going to have that many highly trained staff. You're lucky in a specialized school that deals only with those kind of kids if you have half a dozen of them, frankly. And I think that's going to remain the reality.
All right. Thank you for the call, Mike. Appreciate it. 292-8513, if you'd like to join in our discussion. We're talking about the use of seclusion rooms and how you help, how you deal with students that with severe disabilities, severe emotional disorders, who may become disruptive in a classroom. Barb Trader is with the group TASH that advocates for inclusion in schools. Barb, I mean, what you lay out is really the ideal. But the reality is, as Mike mentioned, our caller, that school budgets are tight. And schools have to balance the needs of the special education students with the needs of other students. What is that balance?
Well, the interesting thing is, if you really understand the high cost of secluding and restraining students, it's far costlier to use those procedures than it is to do the right thing. The studies that have been done by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration and following prevention strategies that have taken place through the state mental health agencies in Pennsylvania, the Centennial School that I mentioned previously, the Grafton School in Virginia, and some public schools, such as Green Bay Public Schools in Wisconsin, those studies have found that there's been a significant decrease in staff injury because they're not physically engaging with students. 87% difference at the Centennial School in staff injury.
What type of school is a Centennial School? Because we're not familiar with that. Is it an inner city school? Is it a suburban school? Is it a school just for special needs students? What, just to give us a quick description of what it is.
It's a private school that receives students that have been sent there from their public school. So it's publicly funded through funds that follow special ed students when they're placed in special schools. But it is a school that is specifically for students with severe emotional and behavioral disabilities. Those schools are actually very tough because the when you have a number of students who have such severe behavioral needs, the staff really does need to be specifically trained. Conversely, when you have students that have severe behavioral challenges that are in inclusive environments and their home school, where there's only one of those students in a classroom, all the other students are students without disabilities, and there's significant support for the teacher. Those students can often be supported very effectively in that environment, and there's only one student to be dealing with in terms of behavior. There are several schools that have taken that as their strategy for dealing with students with very significant behavioral challenges, and particularly school districts that are in states or regions that have fewer dollars to spend on special education.
Okay, and I want to bring in a different perspective here. Greg from Columbus, you're on the air with Barb Trader, the executive director of TASH, a group that advocates for the inclusion of folks with disabilities.
Hi, did you say Greg?
Yes, Greg, you're on the air.
Okay. I'm just curious, I have a brief comment. I feel frustrated because it seems like, once again, a behavioral problem is being categorized as a disability. And I'm not a parenting expert, but I'm just curious and I'm frustrated why, again, these behavioral problems are being categorized as disabilities, and responsibility for dealing with them is uploaded and shifted onto the teachers in the schools. And do the parents have any responsibility for curbing these behaviors in their kids? When I was a kid, I'm 47. If I had behaved like some of these people are referencing, the consequences at home would have been far scarier to me than the consequences at school.
Okay.
And I have to believe that that's part of the reason.
Well, Greg, I think
my friends and I behaved ourselves.
I think we're talking more than just behavior problems. These rooms are aimed at identified students who have been identified ahead of time, if they're used properly, and of students who have been identified as having emotional disorders, a disability that keeps them from behaving appropriately or may cause them to act out in what might look like a bad behavior activity, but it's part of their disorder. Right? Am I correct here, Barb?
Right. I understand and appreciate the caller's frustration, but these kids, the primary focus of behavior interventions is aimed at kids who have a history of behaviors that are usually manifestation of a disability, meaning that because they have a disability, they have, for example, a lack of understanding of their environment. They don't know what is expected of them. They don't have the ability to communicate when they're in pain, when they're frustrated, when something's overstimulating them. So because of those kinds of behavioral challenges and really communication challenges, they act out in ways that really are methods to get what they need, but they evidently aren't, they don't really work that well.
They don't have the same capabilities as other students do. And that really is the root of the problem. I don't think we're talking about students who are just, mouthing off.
Right.
Who need a timeout, but not because of their disability or the disorder. We're going to take a break. We'll come back. We'll talk to a parent who has experienced this firsthand when we continue our conversation about seclusion rooms and the inclusion of special needs students in with other students in schools. When All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Wade Goodwin. Coming up on the next On Point, job retraining programs have bipartisan support, but do they work? And is anyone keeping track? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point this afternoon from 1 until 2 here on 89.7 NPR News. And when you support our station at the annual level of $85, our gift to you is the WOSU Public Media Member Card. The Member Card is good for dining and admission discounts at more than 300 Member Card partners in and around Central Ohio. Save money and support our station with the Member Card. Make a gift of $85 or more. Visit us now at WOSU.org/membercard for more information. And thanks for your support of 89.7 NPR News. 76 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today, a high of 85. Clear skies tonight, a low of 58 degrees. Sunny with a high of 87 on Tuesday, clear skies Tuesday night, a low of 64. And more sunshine on Wednesday, a high of 88. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues with guest host Mike Thompson. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. We are talking about the inclusion of special needs students, students with emotional disorders, disabilities, and with other students in schools. And we're talking about, in particular, the use of seclusion rooms, rooms that are used to separate overly disruptive students. These rooms could be generally small. They oftentimes have matting or padding, sometimes have closed-circuit cameras, sometimes have one-way mirrors. The theory is you put the overly disruptive student in there for a short time, let the student calm down, and bring he or she back to the him or her back to the classroom. But a dispatch and State Impact Ohio investigation found that many schools, are not using them that way and perhaps overusing them. Joining us now is Karen Bodie. She's the mother of a student who was at a Columbus middle school, and that student, her son Drew, was put in a seclusion room and denied lunch. Karen, tell us what was your son doing that prompted educators to put him in the room?
First of all, I need to start off with, you know, a little bit about his disability. Mm-hmm. He was diagnosed with ADHD, oppositional defiant, bipolar, and post-traumatic stress disorder. And they kept a daily on him every single day.
A log.
Mm-hmm. And it tells of the behavior. But one particular day, there was a daily, and it read, I cannot teach your son. He continues to be in the processing room all day, and he's failing my class.
The processing room is the seclusion room.
The seclusion room. Mm-hmm. And it went further to say that I've only seen him one time this year. Well, it had been 45 days into the school year. And so I'm saying to myself, what do you mean you haven't seen him but one time? You know, so I went over to the school without warning, and I told them I wanted everything from his files. And when I proceeded to put all his dailies together, I found out that he had been in the processing room for a total of 20 days consecutively.
Out of the 45 that he
Out of the 45 days, there was 20 documented days where he had been in there, mm-hmm, from the time school started till the time school let out. And the issue came up with the withholding of lunches. So I went to the Ohio Department of Ed and told them what was going on. But I wasn't the only one. There were clinicians that were in the building who had took 20 parents' names and reported it to Children's Services.
What were the reasons the teachers, the educators at your son's school gave for putting your son in this room?
Well, most of the daily's, well, disruptive behavior, whistling, some things like whistling in the class, throwing a pencil, saying that he wasn't going to do things that they asked him to. At one point, one of the dailies said he refused to do classwork and serve a detention, lunches withheld. What was interesting is when we finally got to the hearings was to find out that there was no lunchroom.
So you felt that this was being overused, obviously. You felt that this was being overused and it was being used as punishment, not as a way to help your son who had these disabilities.
Definitely. And when you get a child who has post-traumatic stress, you know, to the point where, you know, a normal hospitalization is 5 days, and he ends up institutionalized for 45 days, to me, you know, that was a little bit overbearing.
So what did you do?
I did the due process hearing, and I filed that. First, I asked questions at the top.
But you took you eventually took your son out of the school.
I took him out. Mm-hmm. I took him out. You know, because there was stipulations that there were certain staff members that he was not allowed to be around. And when it came time for him to go back to school, they put him right back with the same staff.
Barb Trader is the executive director of TASH, a group that advocates for the inclusion of folks with disabilities. Barb, does this sound like a lack of training situation?
Yes, definitely. And it also sounds like a lack of good policy, good administrator oversight, and an ability to live by whatever policy is in place. I'd like to know what the policies are. To allow a school to withhold lunch, that's hard for me to understand why that would be acceptable for any student. Students need their nutrition to get through a day. The other thing that's very alarming here is that the student was not, if the student spent 20 consecutive days in a seclusion room, they're not receiving an education.
Yeah, because you're alone in the room, and they were there for longer than 10, 15, 20 minutes. Let's go to the phones. Creed is on the line. Go ahead, Creed.
Hi. I've actually been an LD or learning disabilities student from when I was about first grade.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm in college now, but I remember these seclusion rooms. I remember them from when I went to school at North Franklin Elementary, actually. And are they misused? Of course they are. I mean, if you're a teacher and you have, you know, a student that's gone out of control, that's, even if you have if this disability or not, I mean, I'm personally am bipolar, but I don't think they would have known that when I was, you know, in first grade.
So share your experience. How long did you spend in these rooms? Were you monitored? What were the things you had done to prompt someone to put you into a room like this?
It was so long ago, I don't really remember. I remember it only took one time in the room to not do whatever I was doing again.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think? Do you think that these rooms should be banned? Or they should be clear policies outlined as to when they can be used? And
I think it's policy and definitely training. It's a training thing because, like, even now I'm fighting this with my niece who's high-functioning autism, and she's in school, and they don't even know that she has it half the time when they go to parent-teacher conferences.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you, Creed. Thanks for sharing your story.
Oh, you're welcome.
Take care. 292-8513. About 10 minutes left if you'd like to share your story. We'd like to hear, especially from educators who have had to cope with this. And what do you think of these rooms? What do you think of the policies? What do you think of the training that's available to help teachers deal with students with emotional and learning disabilities, emotional disorders who may become disruptive? Karen Bodie, the mother of the student we heard the story about just a few minutes ago, what do you think the teachers should have done? How should they have handled your son's disruptive behavior when he became disruptive?
Well, you know, I was always available. You know, half the time when they put Drew in the seclusion room, they never informed me that he was in there that length of time. I'm always available. Matter of fact, I was, excuse me, accused of loving Drew too much. You know, being an overbearing parent. And, you know, let me add this, that most of the time when Drew was in that seclusion room, there was not one child. The Ohio Department of Ed, who did the investigation, stated that there were 5 violent children in that room at one time, and they couldn't feed the children because they were so violent. My thing was this. If you can feed a serial killer on death row, why is it that you can't figure out a way to feed these children? And if they were too violent for the staff to go in, why were they had the children with each other? Drew, he reported, they would close the door and watch through the window at the children beat him up.
Barb Trader from TASH, the group that advocates for inclusion of folks with disabilities. What do you make of that? Have you heard of that before, where more than one student was put into one of these rooms?
That's not a typical report that we hear. What we hear frequently and routinely are two other things that this parent shared. One, parents rarely know that it's happening. Parents are rarely engaged in helping the school district solve whatever problems a child is having that leads to the behaviors that they're seeing. And secondly, that the child is there for long periods of time with no teacher looking at them, watching them, supervising what's happening with them. So in any behavioral intervention that you use, you're only supposed to use something that's as dangerous as what we're talking about, and of course we don't want seclusion to be used, only for the duration of time that it takes to ameliorate the danger. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that's not happening here, and that's a huge concern.
We have an email from Chris, who is the parent of typically developing child who has spent several years in fully inclusive classrooms, and she is it might be a he. This emailer is a strong proponent of the inclusion of children in classrooms, but the emailer wonders, how do you determine, because it's a continuum, you know, there are severely disabled students and, like the caller mentioned, someone who's only mildly autistic. How do you determine if a child belongs in a typical classroom? Barb Trader.
Well, the research shows and our experience suggests that it doesn't really, it's not really dependent on the severity of disability. All children benefit from, if they do not have disabilities, all children benefit from the inclusion of students with disabilities in their classroom, even the most severely disabled student. And all students with disabilities, even the most severely disabled, benefit from being included in a general ed classroom throughout their day. The only thing that may interfere with that is a child who's medically fragile, who medically can't tolerate being in an inclusive environment. And there are those children, thank God, that's a rare situation. And there are some research studies have suggested that students with a learning disability in the third grade level benefit from pullout for reading intervention, but that's it.
But for the students who are disabled, the benefits are there. And my children have been peer buddies at their school where they help other kids with Down syndrome and severe disabilities. And it's been a wonderful experience for them. But from a teaching perspective, if someone is severely disabled or has a severe disorder and they are disrupting the education and affecting the education of the other, you know, 15, 20 kids in the class, that's not a good thing for anybody. Would you agree, Barb?
No, they do not. First of all, we got to get rid of the notion that teaching a child with severe disabilities disrupts other students.
No, I'm not saying all the time, but on occasion, and you advocate for doing away of the seclusion rooms, the seclusion in general. If it takes, you know, 5 or 10 minutes to fix a disruptive situation, that's 5 or 10 minutes that the other students are not being taught.
Well, all students disrupt the classroom on occasion.
Mm-hmm.
Why should a student with a disability be treated differently than all students? So that's the civil rights aspect of being treated like all other students is really important when you're talking about those issues.
Mm-hmm.
The second issue is that a skilled teacher who understands how to do things like differentiate instruction, use universal design for learning in the classroom. These are things that they teach at Ohio State University.
Mm-hmm.
And all other great skills that a highly qualified teacher should come out of the university with.
So all teachers should be trained in how to deal with these situations.
UDL, mm-hmm. UDL is commonly taught.
Mm-hmm.
Those teachers are not only effective at including students with disabilities, but they're also better teachers for all the other students, because all students don't learn the same way.
We just have a minute or so left here. Karen Bodie, your son is returning to public school.
Yes, he is.
Why have you decided to send him back?
Well, excuse me. Not all schools are bad. You know, you have some school staff who care more than others. You know, that was just an unfortunate situation at that school. And I would like to see schools get more engaged in creativity for these children.
I assume you've gotten some assurances from your son is going to a Columbus Public High School.
Yes.
That they are going to be able to handle him, and if there's a problem, they'll call you. What kind of assurances have you gotten?
Well, none yet.
Mm-hmm.
I have to redo his IEP.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll go from there.
So you're just giving it another shot?
Giving it another shot.
All right. Well, we wish you and him well.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for joining us here. Barb Trader, what's your prediction? Do you think these rooms will be done away with, or at least policies very, very much strengthened?
Yes, we are working hard and very hopeful that seclusion rooms will be a thing of the past shortly. They're straight out of the institutional settings that we've also worked hard to walk away from, and there are really effective ways to include and educate students, so that's what we should be focused on.
Thanks very much, Barb Trader. She's the executive director of TASH, a group that advocates for the inclusion of people with disabilities. For more on this story, more on this issue, visit our website, WOSU.org, and click on State Impact. Or to see the Dispatch coverage of this, go to dispatch.com, and you can see the investigative piece on the use of seclusion rooms. That's All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station.